Hi, this is Ryan Briscoe, and you need more front wings.
Hello, and thanks again for joining us for another More Front Wing podcast. This is podcast episode 64, I believe. I'm More Front Wing editor Paul Dalby, filling in the host seat tonight as Steph is getting settled in this evening in Southern California, where she'll be covering this weekend's Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach. So as I say, when the cat's away, the mice will play. So we're going to have a little bit of a guys chat here tonight on the podcast. Joining me for the first time on the podcast, although I think we chatted a couple years ago at the season finale in Miami, he's been called the pride of Monrovia, Indiana, and from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Mr. Mark James. Mark, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Paul, always a pleasure. Anytime that we can talk the Eyes Out Indy Car Series and Firestone Indy Lights, I'm always up for that, no question, especially with the great start that we've gotten off to so far this season here in 2012.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Mark, I've heard Mike call you the Mayor of Monrovia, and it just dawned on me that, I'm afraid your driving credentials may not stack up, though, to a gentleman that, being in Monrovia, I have to assume he's pretty close to your neighbor, and that, of course, is Sprint IndyCar legend Gary Bettenhausen. Is he still in Monrovia down there?
As a matter of fact, Gary lives about a little over a mile and a half from me. When he first moved to Monrovia from Tinley Park back in, I believe it was late 73, he bought a what for years had been a working Christmas tree farm that was owned by the Lynch family. And there were two or three houses on the property at the time. And I think over the years, Gary has lived in each of them, most recently over the last 5 to 7 years. He developed a fair amount of those of that property, and there are upscale homes, custom built homes on that property now, and he has named, for instance, his wife Waveland has a street named after her. I believe the main street through the addition is called Gary's Way, which is the only way, as you well know, with Gary Bettenhausen. But, yeah, the lake that they have on the property, quite frankly, over the years, has really played host to some outstanding drivers / anglers. The likes of Bill Vukovich II and the late Bill Vukovich III. I know they fished there quite a bit, as did Pacho Carter, and the list goes on and on and on. I know our very own driver analyst Davey Hamilton had been out there a time or two over the years. But yeah, Gary's twin sons Todd and Kerry and I went to Monrovia High School together, and also attended Indiana State. It's neat to see Gary from time to time. His wife Waveland works at the middle and high school where I work, and we see each other quite a bit, and it's always nice to catch up with him whenever we have the chance to get together. As a matter of fact, Paul, if you'll indulge me a minute, I don't mean to ramble on, but there's a little bit of Monrovia flavor sprinkled throughout the Eyes Out Indy Car Series. In fact, of course, me being a part of the radio network, and the president of Andretti Autosport, Kyle Moyer, mm-hmm. is a 1982 graduate of Monrovia High School. We went to school together. Kyle got his start in racing, in fact, when we were in high school, working with Gary B on his Sprint Midget and Silver Crown. Kevin Klumper, who is the technical director for Dreyer and Reinbold Racing. His family lives in the Monrovia area. Matter of fact, his daughter is the starting shortstop on the high school softball team. I believe his name escapes me, but there's a freelance photographer that shoots a lot of video for Speed that lives in the Monrovia area. And then Tim Houck works for, Andretti Autosport, and he too is from the Monrovia area originally. So a little bit of racing flavor sprinkled throughout our fair town in central Indiana.
And this is a town of how many people?
I'd say we're right about somewhere between 6,000 and 7,500. So that's a pretty good average.
That's a pretty good chunk of your output there.
Yep, absolutely.
You mentioned Kyle Moyer. Let me clear the air here. Monrovia, I have no doubt, central Indiana, beautiful area. But we're not going to confuse Monrovia with Sydney, Australia, or Melbourne, or anywhere in Australia, right?
How did
Kyle Moyer come to get his Australian accent?
Well, I've been asked that so many times, especially by people on the radio network. The first couple of times that I had mentioned that Kyle and I grew up together, he's He's actually was born, I believe, in central Ohio and then moved to Indiana, I believe, about 78 or 79. And, Kyle always had a rather peculiar way of speaking in terms of his diction. And as a matter of fact, it was always, somewhat guarded to the point to where, and very deliberate that his nickname in high school was Slow-Mo. And that's what we called him. And I think, quite honestly, the years that he spent with Barry Green and Tim Green and Team Green, and that, you know, environment, I think probably had a little bit of an impact. I mean, you know, let's face it. If you took someone who grew up in, say, central Indiana that had no dialect, discernible dialect whatsoever and moved them to the South, eventually they would start to discover that. For instance, if you listen closely, you can pick up a bit of a Southern drawl with Mike King because he's, you know, originally from the Virginia, North Carolina area. But Mike has now been an Indiana resident for 30 years to the point to where most of his Southern accent is all but gone. So that's, I chalk it up more to his environment than anything. But yeah, more than a few people have scratched their head after hearing Kyle speak when I've mentioned to them that he is indeed a proud graduate of Monrovia High School. But, you know, Paul, I can be awfully, publicly and privately proud of Kyle because, you know, he started out working, as I said, for Gary Bettenhausen when we were sophomores in high school. And, you know, some of our classmates poked a little fun at Kyle because, quite frankly, he didn't do it for the money at the time. He was just doing it for the experience. And his goal was to someday, you know, win the Indy 500 in some way, shape, or form. And, if I remember the story right, shortly after we graduated from high school, he threw what he owned into a pickup truck and drove out to California and worked for Dan Gurney for a while. And then I believe he went to work for Rick Gallus. And, I think that's where he got his big break because he was part of the pit crew in 92 when Little Al won the 500 with Rick Gallus. And then moved from there, I believe, to Team Green and was the crew chief, when Jack Villeneuve won the 500 in 95. And Kyle tells the story about, after Villeneuve won the 500 in 95, he went to a Chevy dealership on 38th Street in Indianapolis. He walked a lot and he found a Chevy Silverado pickup, that he really liked. And, he went into the dealership and he found the first salesman he could get his hands on and said, come with me. And he pointed out the truck and said, this is your lucky day. You don't have to sell me a truck. I'm going to buy one because I just won the Indy 500. And as a matter of fact, it's a 95 Chevy Silverado and it still looks showroom new and he still drives it, you know. And a lot of people have probably since forgotten that I don't mean to take anything away from an extraordinary talent, but, I don't hesitate to tell everyone that it was Kyle Moyer's fuel mileage call that got Danica Patrick her lone win in the Izod Indy Car Series at Motegi. It was his goal. He was the one that told her to stay 19 seconds behind the leaders, towards the closing stanza of that race. And she was not agreeing with that over the radio. But I think she became a bit more of a fan of Kyle Boyers when she saw those cars in front of her, like Ed Carpenter and Elio Castroneves, peel off the pit road. And then she saw the twin checkers. I'll never forget her mother saying Kyle Moyer is the man because she knew exactly what had unfolded in front of her. But, you know, Mo's the first guy to give other people the credit. So, that's probably more than Kyle Moyer's been talked about at any stretch of time since he's been in the Izod Indy Car Series. But he really is a neat story, and we're awfully proud of it.
Well, I enjoy hearing some of these other stories that don't always make the press, so thanks for sharing some of those.
Yep.
All right, well, we'll jump then straight from Kyle Moyer, and we'll just that's probably as good a place to start as anywhere. Let's just talk about some of the stuff going on at Andretti Green. Geez, did I just say Andretti Green? I think that's 2 weeks in a row. I've gone back to what, 2008, 2009. Andretti Autosport. They've had a pretty good year this year. You know, I think a lot of people are probably impressed with James Hinchcliffe. We knew he could drive well last year when we saw him at Newman Haas Racing, but I think a lot of people were wondering just exactly what was he going to show when he got into some top flight equipment. You know, coming in with the Chevrolet engine, he's stepping into a very visible seat, taking over for Danica Patrick. I think he's performed admirably both on the track and off the track. And I think the whole team looks good. I think Ryan Hunter-Reay looks solid. I think Marco has looked solid. We saw a run from Marco at Barber 2 weeks ago. That's probably the most aggressive I've seen him on a road course, including his win at Infineon, five years ago now. I think that team's really showing well this year, and the Chevrolet power behind the drivers looks solid. I think they've got three real contenders to be looking for race wins week in and week out.
I don't think that you can give James Hinchcliffe enough credit because, you know, I think people really forget and have forgotten that technically, Paul, James Hinchcliffe is not replacing Danica Patrick. He's replacing Dan Weldon.
True. Very true.
And you know, those are awfully big shoes to fill. And that's not an easy task. I mean, you certainly don't replace Dan Weldon. No one can and no one will, and we know that. No one can be quote unquote replaced. But you think of the pressure that would be on most people, and yet I think just by his demeanor and the fact that he is having so much fun with what he's doing and how he's doing it, I think people now, you know, with the wig that he used at St. Petersburg, I think James has been very calculating from the standpoint that he now has put his personality and his stamp on that GoDaddy car, and I don't think that too much further into the season you're going to have motorsports journalists referring to him as the guy who replaced Danica Patrick. He's simply going to be the driver of the number 27 GoDaddy machine. But, you know, I've thought since the season began that, what a thought process it must have been for James Hinchcliffe, to have to step into that car that he knew was meant for a two-time Indy 500 champion and have the pressure of going along with representing a high-profile not only team, but series sponsor in GoDaddy.com. I mean, let's face it, they're throwing a lot of money at that deal, or at least a lot of attention to it. But I don't think they could have picked a better guy. And you talk about the revitalization and revival, if you will, of Andretti Autosport. I think that we've seen flashes of it over the last year and a half or so with some of the wins that Ryan Hunter-Reay and even Mike Conway and Marco have come up with. But I think more than anything else, and this is not necessarily a negative against Danica, but I think teams have found out in more traditional stick and ball type sports, Paul, that the one thing you absolutely can't buy is chemistry. And I think that's very, very important no matter what the sport is. And clearly they've hit on a chemistry that I think they feel is as close to anything they've had since the days of Dario and Dan and the super team that they had with TK and Brian Herta. I had the chance to interview TK for a fan meet and greet a couple of years ago and ask him about that period of time when he was at Andretti Autosport in the year, of course, he won the championship when he did what no other driver has ever done, and that's complete every lap of every event all year long. And he said there was one point, I think maybe they took two of the three spots on the podium and they were having a big celebration that night at a restaurant somewhere. And right in the middle of the celebration, Michael leaned over to him and said, "Tony, enjoy every minute of this, because for whatever the reason, it'll be gone before you know it, and you'll spend the rest of your career trying to duplicate this." And he wasn't just talking about the winning. He was talking about the relationship with the four of them. And I think, you know, there's much to be said about chemistry. And I think that Andretti Autosport, on both sides of the wall, now with their drivers and their crews, they've had a lot of personnel changes and they've started to hit on what I think is a very good chemistry. And let's face it, having Chevy power doesn't hurt. I think this was a very calculated move on the part of Chevrolet to come back to the series. And Paul, I firmly believe that they came back to the series to not only be competitive and win championships, but I think they have their eye on that prize at 16th in Georgetown. And I think they want to badly win the Indianapolis 500 again. And I think when May rolls around, those with Chevy power, I think will flex a little bit of muscle and be among the teams to beat when we get to the month of May.
I think anybody that gets into IndyCar racing, whether you're on the manufacturer side, whether you're on the chassis side, the team side, the engine side, your goal coming back to IndyCar is to win at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I think Chevrolet is going to be strong there this year. Chevrolet doesn't ever come back without a good hand in their deck. So I think absolutely.
But what's the biggest advantage that they would have over Honda coming back? The biggest advantage I think they would have over Honda is that Honda, while certainly they were working on the development of the new power plant, Honda was also having to make sure that they supplied the previous power plant to the series.
Absolutely.
And make sure that it was up to snuff. What could Chevrolet focus on? They could focus solely on the development of the new power plant. And I think that's what I think has appeared to put them a little ahead of the curve.
And the development team behind that Chevrolet engine's got a pretty good history in the Elmore engineering.
Yep. No question. I'm happy to see the competition. I know you are too. And that I know that, you know, in talking to Kevin Plumper tonight at the softball game, as a matter of fact, Kevin was, you know, they're scratching their head a little bit over Lotus, but, they knew what they were getting, in terms of Lotus being behind the eight ball a little bit because of jumping into the pool a little bit late. But let's face it. I mean, you're talking about Lotus. You're not talking about a franchise or a name or a company that doesn't have a history of success. And I think if those teams that are firmly behind Lotus, will be patient with them, and work on their growing pains together. I know it's a tough thing to do because let's face it, it's an ego driven business that these guys want to win. Everyone from the technical directors to the engineers, to the crew, to the drivers, they want to win. And they don't like being down on power and don't like being behind the eight ball and not being able to do anything about it. But I think if they'll just be patient, good things will eventually happen because we've talked about this before in many, many circles. Remember the first time Bobby Rahal came to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Honda. He bailed on him after the first weekend. And then how many years was Honda, the only power plant at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway? So, you know, I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen to Lotus someday. I'm just simply suggesting that eventually they're going to get up to speed and they too will be very, very competitive.
Talking again with Mark James of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. Mark, you've been on site for both of the races. You had a chance to be at the spring training. Have you gotten a sense from being around the Lotus teams and the Lotus development group led by John Judd? Have you gotten a sense of really how far behind they feel they are? We keep hearing, you know, we were 6 months behind, we're, you know, 6 weeks behind development. Have you gotten a sense of what the general feeling in the paddock is to when they may be able to catch up?
No, the only thing that I think they're able to relate to teams is that they realize there's an issue and they're doing everything they can and throwing every man hour at it that they possibly can to get themselves up to speed. And again, as I said, I mean, people need to remember. I mean, Lotus is a proud name associated with racing. I mean, for those of you that have been fortunate enough to go to Barber Motorsports Park and go to the Barber Motorsports Museum, even though that originally was designed as a tribute to the two-wheel variety, there's a pretty impressive Lotus display in that museum and had a really nice celebration there a year ago celebrating the return of Lotus to American open-wheel racing. And I think, again, while there's a level of frustration, certainly among, the engineers there themselves, certainly a level of frustration among the teams and the team owners, that Lotus supplies, it's gonna have to, you're gonna have to have a hurry up and wait mindset, I suppose, is the only answer at this point. And I know that's not what, fans of those teams and drivers like to hear, you know, it is what it is, and it's the hand you've chosen. It's the one you've dealt with, and as I said, I can't put a firm date on it. Don't get a feel for a firm date on it, but I firmly believe at some point, all of a sudden, they're going to get the proverbial ducks in a row, and you're going to see three uh, very competitive, very reliable power plants. And, you know, there are rumors out there, but that there may be, you know, more coming online in 2013 or 2014. We'll have to see. But for now, I think these three, before very, very long, will all three be equally reliant and equally competitive.
Just as a side note, because I like throwing random facts in here, I had heard the rumor that at Barber in the Lotus Museum that you had spoken about, that the original, either the original car that Mario Andretti or one of his teammates in 1969, the Lotus that was destroyed in practice before Mario went to the Bronner Hawk, my understanding is that car or one of the replicas is in that Lotus Museum down there. Have you seen that car?
I believe it is a replica. You know, my memory escapes me as to the exact details, but yeah, it's a pretty impressive piece of equipment. And the funny thing about that museum is, what George Barber, who built the track and designed the museum, one of the things that he insists upon is that, from what I understand, with a little bit of oil and a little bit of gasoline, the maintenance crew there that is responsible for all of the equipment that you see in the museum, they have to be ready to be started at a moment's notice.
Wow.
That's the condition that he expects them to be kept in. And that's the condition that they are kept in.
Pretty impressive. That's amazing. Well, before we get too far off Barber, let's just, you know, as we continue this hopscotch of topics here, let's talk about the Barber race, because that Barber race, from my seat on my couch, was one of the best IndyCar road races I've ever seen. I mean, you can talk about the last year, the last 5 years, or ever. That was one of the most fun races to watch. There was everything you would want in a race on a road course. There was a driver coming from the fifth row to win. There was passing. There was a little bit of aggressive driving. There was some great fuel strategy. There was clean driving. I think it had it all. And for a track that's been labeled as the quote unquote gorgeous facility that IndyCars can't pass on, it's built for motorcycles. How is IndyCar able to come in this year and put on such a fantastic show? Is it all just to the new cars?
Yeah, I think you've got a point to that. Certainly, I think that's what made it more competitive. And you know, there's certainly no question that if you had the opportunity to be out front, the clean green racetrack was the thing to have. But I think if you look from positions 2 on back to 15 or 16, we had the opportunity to see some great racing and some great passing. And I think the drivers were to a man and woman, were absolutely worn to a frazzle after the race was over. But I think from all the thoughts and impressions that we got from the drivers, that they really had a good time. They enjoyed racing, and they enjoyed the quality of racing. And I think it speaks well to the combination of the redesigned chassis and the engine package, and I think all that does is set us up to think that some of the places that we've been in the past that where passing has been difficult, places like Baltimore and Infineon, and certainly going back to Belle Isle and Detroit, I think we see an opportunity there for an increased quality of racing on those courses too. I'll be honest with you. I'm one of those quote unquote purists that prefer, you know, turning left and running on ovals. And I won't say that when it was first announced that the Izod IndyCar Series was going to start turning right and left, that I was too terribly excited about it. I mean, I still sometimes get out my old media guides and look back at the days when we had 14, 15, or 16 ovals a year. And I won't say that there's not a part of me that still doesn't long for those days, but I can say that not towing a company line by any stretch of the imagination, I have certainly bought in. And to people who don't understand them and don't get them, Paul, I describe them in this manner, that ovals to me are pure racing. I mean, it's pure speed and it's pure racing. I think when you're looking at a road and street circuit, especially when you go to a place like Baltimore or Barber, certainly St. Petersburg, Paul, I don't call those races, I call them events. And I know they're called Grand Prix, but I call them events in that there is so much going on and there is so much to see and do. And it's just, it's an experience. It's like going to an amusement park of sorts, and it just so happens there's a race going on. But I think that we stepped outside of that at Barber a little bit with everything that went on there, as you suggested, with the pit strategy and the fuel mileage, the passing and whatnot. And not only did it become an outstanding event, but it turned into a great race. And I just can't say enough good things about George Barber and his outstanding staff. Southern hospitality is more than just a saying, Paul, and it's certainly more than just a saying at Barber Motorsport Park. And those people in the great state of Alabama and the Deep South have just embraced that event, and it continues to grow and get bigger and better. And I think as an event that follows, you know, our season opener at St. Petersburg, I think they just do an awfully impressive job of hosting an ICE IndyCar Series event at Barber Motorsports Park.
Well, I think when it comes to the split between road and street courses versus ovals, I think I fall very much in the same boat as you do. Prior to the unification of 2008, I was very solidly in the IndyCar Series side. I really like the ovals. I like the 1.5 mile ovals. I like the speed and the closeness of those. And I compared the crafts of them a couple weeks ago in an article on the IndyCar Nation website. I compared them to a little bit. If you look at a Rocky movie, let's talk Rocky IV, for instance. An oval, that's your Ivan Drago. That's just come out of the gate. It's hard. It's beating you right up front from the very beginning. It's high action. It's fast. It's strength. Rocky is more like the road course. There's a finesse to it. There's a little more strategy. You got to use, you know, all of your tools to really be successful. Both types of fighters are successful. Different strokes for different folks. And I think the IndyCar fans that can learn to enjoy the best aspects from either of them, as I hope I have done. And I still prefer the ovals, but I still at times enjoy the road courses for sure. I think those that embrace both sides certainly are able to get a higher level of satisfaction from the series. And I think those are the ones that are now looking at the series and saying, wow, this series has really gone places. There's great momentum in this formula that we're on. Although I think everyone would like to see some more ovals for sure. I think 3 or 5 or whatever we have this year is a little on the short side. But I think those that are seeing the overall picture, not the microscopic pinpoint view, but looking from the larger picture here, I think they're the ones that are seeing the momentum gained in the series and how they're going forward year after year here.
Well, I don't know who's to blame. I mean, there are people that say that the promoter's to blame. There are people that will say the series is to blame. But let's face it, Paul. I mean, when you can go to Barber Motorsports Park and race in front of all of the people that we race in front of, does it make good economic sense or sense from a growth standpoint to go to New Hampshire and race in front of 15,000 or 16,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And for whatever the reason, I mean, I'll tell you, I think the only negative to Michael Andretti promoting the race at Milwaukee is that I firmly believe that Michael Andretti has an opportunity to kind of show people just how inept the previous promoters were of that event. Because I think Michael is poised to all of a sudden make that event explode and be huge. Because first and foremost, he's making it affordable. Not only that, but he's promoting the crap out of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's where it suffered in the past, but let's face it. I mean, the Andretti's know how to market and they know how to promote because that's what they've done for years, and that goes all the way back to Mario. But let's face it. I mean, as a business model, you can't go to an oval and race in front of 15,000 to 25,000 people when you can go to Baltimore and race in front of 150,000, 160,000 people over the course of a weekend. It just doesn't make sense. And so all of these people that profess to be these purists, just like, for instance, last year at Milwaukee. I mean, Paul, there's all of these people out there that want USAC to be the road to Indy. They want midget sprint Silver Crown drivers to stop going to NASCAR and want them to come and run to the ICE IndyCar Series. Well, Paul, we had almost every ladder on the road to Indy at Milwaukee last year with USF 2000 and Star Mazda and the USAC cars, and the thing didn't draw flies. For whatever the reason. And, you know, I remember going to Richmond and seeing the USAC sprints and Silver Crown cars run at Richmond, and it didn't draw anybody. It just didn't draw anybody. So, you know, if you're Randy Bernard and you're the ICE IndyCar Series, and, you know, a place like Houston, Texas is going to come along and offer you the chance to run around Reliant Stadium, and they already have one of the most recognizable business symbols in the world in Shell and Pennzoil on board as title sponsor. Where are you going to go?
Right.
You're going to go to Houston. You're going to run a road street course there. You know, until that changes, until the promotion changes of the Oval events, I think you might see the balance of power, shifted towards or turn right and left.
Speaking of business and ovals, I read an article today, and I don't know if it was an Autosport or Racer or where I read it. It was a great interview with Roger Penske today. And the question came up, and I'm paraphrasing here. Basically, the question was, do you regret selling Michigan Speedway and California Speedway to ISC now? And Roger, in so many words, basically said, you know, yeah, I do. You know, I sold it at a time where the racing venue industry was getting saturated. You know, basically said ISC made me a good offer and they could run it. And unfortunately, he sees now, I think, that ISC doesn't necessarily have the interest of IndyCar at heart. And the question was asked of him, you know, would you consider purchasing those tracks back? And Roger kind of dodged the question a little bit, but finally came back and said, you know, if they made me an offer, we would probably pursue that. But it's not necessarily something that's on the top of his list right now.
Right.
I think if Roger Penske was in the oval business still, and I think you kind of have to look at that a little bit as a turning point of when the oval started to really go away from kart, was about the time Roger Penske sold his two tracks to ISC. And of course the spectator fatality at Michigan in 2000, 1999, 2000, 2001, certainly that had an adverse effect as well. But if you look at kart races from that era, they still had very solid attendance there. And after Roger Penske sold his tracks to ISC, it was like somebody shut the lights off there. And all of a sudden, oval racing, particularly in kart, really, really struggled. And then as some of the kart teams moved over, you know, a little bit more of the focus of the IZOD IndyCar Series, or the IRL at that time, shifted a little bit, started in 2005 toward the road and street, and it's gained a little bit more and more. And we've seen this shift and this focus more toward the road and street, and the ovals have suffered. I mean, you can just list off, you could sit here all night and list off tracks that have gone by the wayside. You could talk Chicago, Kentucky, Nashville, Kansas, Nazareth, Pikes Peak, Richmond, you know, Homestead, you name them. There's all over the country.
What's the common thread among all those tracks, Paul?
Well, let's see. Kansas, Chicago, Richmond, ISC, Michigan, California. Well, there's one common thread. Hold on, let me find another one. Kentucky, New Hampshire. Stop me if we find the thread here. There you go. ISC, SMI.
Yeah. Well, I will say this. In the time that I've been involved in the series, I think for the most part, I think the folks at SMI and Bruton Smith and his group, I think all in all they've been very, very good to the IZOD IndyCar Series. I mean, you know, Eddie Gossett, certainly at Texas Motor Speedway, bought into the concept of the IZOD IndyCar Series from the very beginning. I mean, one of the saddest days for me personally is when Mr. Gossett, and I understand he and Bruton Smith, again, it is at the end of the day a business. I often chuckle a bit at sometimes the suggestion of what the, you know, almost the suggestion that somehow the IZOD IndyCar Series owes him something. And I think they do owe him a bit because of his loyalty, but let's not forget, it was their call to do away with the fall race, because they wanted to attract another cut date. And I get that, but let's just not forget it. Let's not act as though that didn't happen, because it did. but that said, I was working pit road, the race in Charlotte, when the spectator was killed. when we had the spectator fatality at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And sadly, I think it was the media in Charlotte, who didn't want us there to begin with, who did everything they could to make sure that we never came back. And that was unfortunate because, Paul, that night, where that incident occurred, that was a section of bleachers that originally weren't scheduled to be open, but it had to be open because of the demand for tickets.
Hmm.
I mean, that event continued to grow year in and year out. Vegas, I think, remember Las Vegas went away from the schedule at a time when, first of all, it was under a different ownership group and the date kept getting moved around. I think the decision, whosever it was, to move the Kentucky date to October was absolutely not the right call. It's the wrong time of the year, not only because of the weather, but because of the fact that it's football season and, people's focus is on other things, especially when you're competing against both the Bengals and the Colts in that particular market. That was a pretty good event, I think. But again, much of the success that we had early on, with Kentucky was under a different ownership group. And I think it suffered from the change in date last fall, and it's a shame that we couldn't get back there. But I don't know that it's necessarily fair to make the comparison between SMI and ISC in terms of not, aiding in the growth of the IndyCar series, because again, they've done all they could at Infineon Raceway. And, and hopefully that will continue to grow. But, yeah, there have been more than a few people that have speculated that ISC was not quite the good partner to the IndyCar series that they professed to be at the time, and that their relationship was more born out of a desire to live by the old adage that you keep your friends close and your enemies closer, because they're easy to control that way.
I'll tell you, the last race the Eyes Out IndyCar series had at Chicago Speedway, what would that be? 2010, I guess it was, when about 8,000 people showed up. That was probably, if I can put my fan hat on for a few minutes, that was probably one of the most insulting race weekends. I think from a fan, I was probably more insulted that weekend by how the series was treated by the staff and the personnel there at Chicagoland Speedway. It was 6-7 weeks out from the NASCAR weekend. All of the NASCAR memorabilia was still up. The banners in the media room were still up. There was absolutely nothing anywhere online, in their digital world, on their infrastructure. There was nothing to indicate that the IndyCar series was there. The president of the Speedway, I don't even know if he ever showed up during the race weekend. It was just completely devoid. It was as if IndyCar had rented the track like they did at Las Vegas. It was as if they rented the track, and the track gave absolutely no effort toward making that a successful weekend.
I agree with that. And I also think that that's another event that, quite frankly, suffered from a poor choice in dates, because, you're not going to be able to draw people to Chicagoland Speedway for an IndyCar race on the opening weekend of the NFL season when the Chicago Bears are playing Soldier Field. It's not going to happen.
Nope.
And I'm sorry, it doesn't, to me, take a scheduling genius to sit down and figure out that that's not going to work. Plus, let's not forget, one of the issues that we had at both Kansas and Chicagoland Speedway, if I remember right, is that those places both for a number of years put together that season ticket package deal to where you had to buy tickets for all of the events. You could not walk up to the window and buy a ticket. And at no time do I think that hampered this series more than when Danica Patrick won the race at Twin Ring Motegi, because if I remember right, our next scheduled event was at Kansas Speedway, and I'm thinking, okay, we have no way to promote the fact that you can see Twin Ring Motegi winner Danica Patrick at Kansas Speedway, because you could walk up to the ticket office and buy a ticket. You either had to buy it from StubHub or you had to buy it from a scalper, and I'm convinced that people are going to do that for most races other than the Indy 500. I mean, you literally could not go to the box office at Kansas Speedway and buy a ticket for that race after Danica won Motegi. You couldn't use that as the promotional tool that you always dreamed that you could use it for.
I guess I would play a little bit devil's advocate, though, where I, as a fan that attended at Chicagoland Speedway when that was part of a season ticket package, I think there's no doubt, though, that attendance at the IndyCar, the actual attendance at the event, was buoyed by the fact that NASCAR fans had to purchase those tickets and didn't necessarily want to just throw away $65. So, you know, we'll go out here, we'll spend an afternoon or an evening there, and we'll watch some racing with these funny-looking cars that people that I don't know and that don't speak English, and, you know, we'll go investigate and see what it is, and then we'll be done for the year.
I'll give you that, but I still think the best way to have handled that would be to give those people their season ticket packages for the NASCAR events that you hold there, and then make the Izod IndyCar Series ticket a separate deal. Now, as you suggest, that you're potentially setting yourself up for a poor turnout, but at least at a place like Kansas and Chicagoland, let's face it, at that particular time, it continues to grow, especially with the addition of Rubens Barrichello and drivers of like that, and James Hinchcliffe. But let's face it, at that time, the pulse and the heartbeat of open wheel racing, the Izod IndyCar Series was stationed in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way that their sales packages were designed, it was very, very difficult for people who were fans and supporters and followers of the series to feel as though that they could show up on race day and be able to buy a ticket and sit in the stands and root on the favorite drivers.
Right. Well, let's turn the corner just a little bit then, since we're talking about tracks and schedule. Let's talk just a little bit about some of the rumors for 2013 coming up. For once, we finally are hearing about some ovals that may possibly get on the schedule. The ones that I've heard kicked around, I've heard Richmond kicked around, I've heard Pocono kicked around, which I think would be an interesting thing. I've heard Kentucky would like to get back on the schedule. So there's three ovals, and of course we've got California coming back this year. Anything else that I'm missing there? You think any of those are likely?
Did you mention Phoenix?
I did not mention Phoenix. I have
okay. That's the one that seems to be in the public consciousness the most. Pocono is a relative newcomer to the game with the ownership group there and the resurfacing of the facility. I would say that if we go to tracks like California Speedway and we would mark a return to Pocono, I would like to see those events become at least 400 milers instead of 300 milers.
Yeah,
I think that would add a bit more strategy to the game and quite frankly. Let's face it, Paul, you're asking for a pretty hefty investment for people to come out and watch a race that you could run in an hour and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
if you don't have a lot of cautions. And I just don't think that's enough time to be entertaining people, especially if that is the standalone event on that particular weekend. I do like the qualifying format that they developed on the ovals with some of the heat races and whatnot. I think that's going to be very interesting and finally add the I think badly needed element of excitement to qualifying on ovals, save for the Indy 500. But there's a couple of other tracks out there that we didn't talk about. That one that obviously will never come back, which I would love to see come back at some point, would be Pikes Peak International Raceway.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one, it has some new ownership and it's not too far away. And I think we went there a couple of years, and the last year we went there, the promoters finally decided to step up, tie in with the St. Louis Cardinals, and I think we had the best crowd that we had in the 3 or 4 years that we went, and it wouldn't be too far away for guys like you and me, and our family of friends is Gateway in St. Louis. I mean, that's a neat little racetrack, and it provides, I think, an opportunity for us to draw somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to 55, which would make everybody happy. But regardless of where we go, we get back to the conversation that we were having, 10 to 15 minutes ago. I'm for whoever and wherever wants to step up and be a good partner with the series and actually truly promote the event. Do what they can to make it a fan-friendly event, make it an affordable event, and do what they can to get people to come out and watch the Izod IndyCar Series. Make them feel like that they're getting a bang for their buck. And I will say this, and obviously I'm not in his hip pocket and I'm not on his payroll, but I will say this, with everything that is being attempted at Milwaukee Speed, at the Milwaukee Mile by Michael Andretti and his group, if that event is not successful, then it is not meant for the Izetta Dakar Series to race there. I will be absolutely floored if that event is not successful in terms of having 45, 50,000 people or more there. And hopefully that will cause other promoters to step up and say, we need to take a look at how he did this and what he did. And we need to maybe, to take some notes on that and employ it, you know, at our facilities. I mean, we're most likely never going to draw 145,000 people at Richmond. But I think 65 or 70,000 is doable as long as we get the right date and we could, you know, we could go back there and race there on a Saturday night and the event would be promoted. I think we would be very, very successful at Phoenix given the right set of circumstances, but you can't go to Phoenix and expect to be successful on a weekend when Arizona is playing in the NCAA tournament. There's spring training baseball going on. The world's largest air show is being held, and there's an LPGA event being held in Phoenix. You're not going to compete with all of that. And that was always the problem with the date before, was the timing of it and the competition that we had to battle for the buck out there. I mean, we lost that battle each and every year. And we first of all have to find the right date that makes the event successful. And then I think the series has to work with the promoter of the event to make sure that it's successful. And if they're just looking to fill dates and aren't willing to put their promotional money where their mouth is, then I would say that there's too many people out there like George Barber and the folks at Houston and the folks at Baltimore that are willing to embrace the series when it comes to them.
Yeah. Speaking of Phoenix, I think it's a good sign that that Randy Bernard Mr. Sperber, the president of the track out there, hopefully, excuse me, I think they have shaken hands and kissed and made up after, you know, Randy, as much as the fans adore it, has a tendency sometimes to speak before he thinks. And I don't think it was necessarily great for the public relations when Randy called out Mr. Sperber last year on Kirk Cavan and Kevin Lee's show. And basically, well, I think he actually did say that he didn't feel that the president of Phoenix International Raceway was, I think he said he's not worth a damn in my book. And certainly that probably didn't go over well, but my understanding is they've mended bridges and, you know, there certainly is no announcement imminent that IndyCar is going to return there. But I think it seems like the hope is at least further along now than it was. We saw Marco Andretti and J.R. Hildebrand testing out there a few months ago. And the president at least said along the lines that if IndyCar is to return, he wants to see a full, you know, a larger compatibility test to make sure that they would be compatible with the new configuration out there. So it sounds like there's at least overtures that the door may be cracked. So we'll see what happens.
Is there another oval track in the United States of America that has a longer and more storied history in open wheel racing than Phoenix International Raceway? And I'm not talking about just in IndyCar style racing. I'm talking about USAC. I mean, right. The Copper World Classic, for instance, Princeton Silver Crown. I mean, we've been racing there for years. And again, a long and storied history. And, for some reason, been unable to recapture that sort of magic, but hopefully in the not too distant future, if an agreement can be reached, we can get back there and everybody that has asked for so mightily for Phoenix to come back to the schedule will pony up some ticket money and get there. We'll have a great crowd and that event will continue to grow and both will prosper because of it.
All right, another topic here. Bo Barfield, can you put your finger on the pulse of what this guy and his demeanor, his overriding persona, his way of running the show, what's that meant to the IndyCar series this year?
I think that certainly any time that you have a change in race control to the extent in which that we've had a change. I think it it provides for an interesting scenario. I think that he would perhaps be the first to tell you, or at least maybe he should be among the first to admit that it's probably a good thing that the decision making process is something that he's going to be able to work his way through in the first couple of races of the season on courses like St. Pete and Barber and certainly Long Beach. I would hate to think that, you know, not questioning his abilities or his decision making process, but let's be honest, I don't think you'd want to throw a guy into that situation regardless of how many years experience he had at a place like Iowa and make that his first race out of the gate. But I think honestly I think that's where the true test will come in when we get to that oval stage and we're running at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and we're also, you know, running at Iowa and Milwaukee and places like that. I think that's when you'll be able to more adequately and accurately grade the impact that he's had on the series. Certainly has an outstanding pedigree and a great background. And I also think that, you know, it makes a tremendous amount of sense to have, two experienced racers like Johnny Unser and Ari Lyandike, the two-time 500 winner, in race control with him. Because I think what that does as much as anything is that continues this practice that we've had in this series by making sure that regardless of the level of experience that Bill Barfield had as a driver at whatever series that he drove in, let's face it, no disrespect to him intended, but don't you think drivers are going to be a little quicker to want to communicate with Ari and Johnny than they are with Bill Barfield? And then they provide the filter in getting maybe some concerns back to him, and they could filter the stuff from him back to the driver. So I think that chain of command is a pretty solid one. And again, Johnny has a lot of experience in race control and even on ovals in some of the Mazda Road, the Indy series. So, I think it's a good scenario. I really do. Let's be honest. It's unfortunate in my opinion, the fire in which that Brian Barnhart was under, especially over the past couple of years. And you know, I've always been of the opinion that it's one thing to disagree with someone. It's one thing to not care about how someone is doing their job, and you have every right in the world to express that contention. But I think once you resort to doing so personally and taking cheap shots, to me personally, that's when your message loses validity. And I'm not saying this because I work for the company, but and I'm sure there's drivers and owners out there that would disagree because they see him in a far different light than I ever did. But I know this, in all the dealings that I ever had since 1996, at one level or another with Brian Barnhart, he was never anything but a class act and professional. He never backed away from any question that we asked him. And I think in his heart of hearts, Brian Barnhart cares about the Izod IndyCar Series, every team and every driver to a man and a woman. And, I think that, that Brian made some great calls over the years. Did he make some mistakes? Yes, the decision to go back to Green Flag Racing last year at New Hampshire was a curious one at best. You know, who knows why that decision was made, when it was made, because I, for one, was standing right above one of the observers in turn three. And Paul, I'm telling you, it was flat raining on me when we were going back to green. And I just absolutely didn't understand it at the time. And I've never had the opportunity to sit down and talk to him about it, ask him about it. Not sure that he would answer me, and he doesn't have to answer me. But certainly some of the criticism, it's part of the game, and I get that. But I would just, it's just unfortunate to me when criticism turns into personal attacks. And I thought too many times last year by people, in the media and on the blogs and on the threads, I think resorted to personal attacks against Brian Barnhart. And again, to me, that was unfortunate.
I couldn't say it any better than you have. I would echo every sentiment you said. I, too, in my dealings with Brian, he's been nothing but professional and personable to me. Never shied away from any of the questions we've asked him. Didn't try to dart around answers. I think, unfortunately, once the snowball started going down the hill, there was just no stopping. And as you said, there were many that enjoyed the opportunity to fan the flames.
One in particular.
Certainly one in particular, but there are the... I don't want to say the legions, but certainly close associates and counterparts of his that enjoyed fanning those flames as well, and certainly didn't shy away from doing it on their own. But unfortunately, the way it turned out, there was a crisis in confidence. I think I've been labeled sometimes as a Brian defender, and probably because I have had the opportunities to interact with him on a personal basis, and he's been forthright and open to me. He admits when he makes mistakes. There's not anyone in the IZOD IndyCar series who hasn't made an error in their role, and that can be, you know, you can talk about Dario Franchitti, you can talk about Tim Cindric, you can talk about Brian Barnhart, you can talk about Mark James. There's
That's
nobody
right.
associated that hasn't made an error in their role. Unfortunately, Brian Barnhart's errors were under a microscope, and I think, you know, certainly once that crisis in confidence took hold and continued to grow, unfortunately, there was no going back. So I understand why the move had to be made, but I think if some of the same decisions that are necessarily made by Bo Barfield were made by Brian Barnhart, I don't think that Brian would have the leniency that Bo Barfield is getting this year. And that's not to take anything away from Bo by any stretch of the imagination. I think he's done a great job. I think that Brian inherited, and inherited is probably the wrong word because of his position, but there were things that were brought into Brian's purview. If you want to talk about double file restarts, if you want to talk about the blocking rule that was so unpopular, that wasn't even Brian's call. It wasn't even Brian's call. It came in with Tim Cindric, came in with Tony Kottman. Well, who was voting for Tony Kottman to be put in charge of everything?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I was in on the meeting. I was in on the meeting that Brian Barnhart had with the media at St. Petersburg last year. And he said that, you know, double file restarts, and some of the changes, it's what the owners said that they wanted. And he said, guys, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. And he said, again, the problem that we ran into is that we had guys wanting us to run our events the way NASCAR runs their events. And you are comparing apples to oranges. They're two vastly different animals, two vastly different disciplines, two vastly different sets of circumstances. And he said, you're gonna run into an issue. And I'm telling you, this rule change, I think, with opening up pit road, right away under caution, I think you're gonna find a situation. I was talking to Tim Tuttle, who does a lot of work for the, Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indy 500 program, and Tim writes for SI.com and is one of the most respected motorsports writers in the world. He was talking about an event, he said, tonight, as a matter of fact, I saw Tim, and he was talking about an event at Vancouver in which, you know, Al Unser Jr. was far and away the fastest driver in the field and ended up on pit road at the wrong time during a caution when the pits were open, and he ended up at the rear of the field and lost the race because of it. As Brian suggested with these rule changes, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. And, I think we might find that there will be some issues from time to time if we're going to do portions of our rule book in pencil throughout the course of the season. I'm not sure that during the season is a good time to be making radical changes to the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I think you give an opportunity to assess things. The late Al McGuire once said about rules committees, whenever they make decisions to make changes on rules, they need to leave them alone for at least 2 years. And let's see exactly how the game is affected, because it takes at least a couple of years before those rules to be able to take full effect. But the problem is they meet and make decisions to simply justify their existence, and they're not always making decisions in the best interest of the sport. I mean, I've received, and maybe you can get confirmation on this, you've got the same email. It appears as though that no matter where he qualifies, that James Hinchcliffe is going to have to start 10 spots back at Long Beach because of an engine change after the test at Sonoma. That's an interesting ruling at best. Same thing with Simon Pagenaud, who lost 10 spots in the season opener. For all intents and purposes, the way he ran, if it weren't for that change, Paul, he could have had a chance to win that race.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're those teams halfway through the season, you know, Davey Hamilton, our driver analyst, said as co-owner of Schmidt Hamilton Racing, that even though they don't think the rule is fair, if the engine manufacturer suggests the engine change, he doesn't think that that's fair. But he doesn't want them to change it now because they've already been punished because of it. But I said, but Davey, what if it happens to you again? Then you won't mind the rule being changed. He said, well, no, of course not. You know, but I'm not. I can see that if it happens in a race weekend, but to me that's difficult to fathom when it happens during a test.
You know, it's interesting you bring this up, because that was the next thing I wanted to actually, the exact thing I wanted to ask you was about this Hinchcliffe ruling. And Bo Barfield, to his credit, has been on Twitter tonight for the last, couple hours discussing with fans this ruling. So I give him credit for the transparency. I as well, I don't like the rule. I guess I can sort of, if I stretch my imagination, I can sort of justify the Pagenaud and the Tagliani, since the engine malfunctions happened during a race weekend, even though they were the previous weekend, I guess, for Tagliani. And I don't recall if Pagenaud's was or not. No, it was the same weekend. You know, I guess I could stretch my imagination and get that. It's an event. If you change an engine during an event, that being a three-day weekend, then you suffer the penalty. Okay, I can sort of kind of justify that. But James Hinchcliffe is a test.
Right.
It's a test.
Right. Yeah.
That's very difficult for the fans to get their hands around. And then let me ask you this. What now, if that's the case, if James Hinchcliffe goes to Infineon and blows his engine and now he has to start, 10 spots back, what now will keep Michael Andretti and the folks from Chevrolet from, let's say, Sebastian Saavedra, who's already on Andretti's payroll? What if he goes out in a non-entered car and starts running tests now? So that he blows an engine in this other car? You know, if this is a development test and they're out there for Chevrolet to learn and to make their engines better and figure out where they can gain, but they're going to do it while risking the positions of their actual drivers, what's going to keep Michael Andretti from going out and purchasing a chassis from Dallara that isn't assigned to an entrant, with a Chevrolet engine that isn't assigned to an entrant, with a driver who isn't an entrant in the IndyCar series, and let him do all the testing? Well, now you've just added a chassis, a car, and a driver to your payroll.
Yeah, and that's a very good observation. And it's interesting you should mention that, because I think Sebastian is scheduled to do some testing for Andretti Autosport. At least that's what Sebastian told me when we talked about the deal. But I think at the end of the day, what it basically boils down to is, and again, this is just me, looking at it as an observer, the rule is in place for one reason and one reason only. They want to make sure the engine manufacturers don't cheat and say they need to replace an engine when they don't really need to. That's what it boils down to. But as I've discussed, among, my cohorts with the IMS Radio Network, Let's face it, at the end of the day, are these engine manufacturers at this point in the game, Paul, really equipped to be changing engines on a whim to gain a couple of more mile an hour?
Exactly.
I don't think they're in that position with product. I really don't. And so I don't know that that's necessarily an effective, sensical rule and that I think should be employed, I think, when a team is at a test. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think you would probably be able to get more support for that ruling if you were to confine it to race weekends. But I don't know. I guess the outcry, as we have learned with the changes that we have seen in the series, I think the louder people jump up and down and yell and scream, and the more attention they attract to themselves over this particular ruling, will, I think, eventually lead to some sort of modification, if not an all-out reversal. So, or at least reducing the penalty from 10 spots to 5, perhaps.
It is going to be interesting. This is the first real fan blow-up, if you will, that Bo Barfield has faced. So it will be interesting to see how he handles this. The other issue that you mentioned was the pit change, and that kind of goes right into us to a quick preview of Long Beach, because I know we're already going long here. It's interesting. I've long advocated. I don't like the pack-up, not the pack-up rule under yellow, but the closing of the pits until the field is packed up. I think it makes it dangerous. I think it really brings more danger into the pit stops than really needs to be there. I think we've seen a lot of incidents because of this. There's so much emphasis for the teams to shave tenths and quarters of a second off. And that's when things like wheel nuts don't get attached, when fuel probes don't get taken out of the socket in time. I just think it's made pit stops more dangerous. So I've been a fan of not closing them, get the cars in as they come. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. What's interesting, 2 points here. When the pits were closed, when that first happened, I believe it was 1992, in Indianapolis at least, it was 1992, not only did they close the pit stops, but that was the first year for the pit speed limit as well. So right. we haven't seen in the last 20 years, oh my gosh, is it 10 years? No, it has been 20 years. Oof. We haven't seen what is the effect of leaving the pits open when you have a speed limit? Because as you recall from 1991 previous, when the pits were open, and I'm sure you remember many times at Indianapolis when cars would scream down pit lane, you know, doing 185, 190 miles an hour. And I would never advocate going back to those days by any stretch of the imagination. But what will the effect be of leaving the pits open but requiring that reduced speed? I don't think we're going to know what happens there until it actually gets into practice. My second point is there is an irony to this whole situation of opening the pits right away and adjusting pit rules at Long Beach when it was in 1991 an incident on pit road at Long Beach that led to or certainly helped contribute to the closing of pits, and that was the incident between Emerson Fittipaldi and Michael Andretti, I believe, where
right.
Michael ended up on just about on Emerson's lid. So it's interesting they decided to open the pits here at Long Beach. And that they've historically had a very difficult pit lane there.
Yeah, and then certainly I think the main concern with keeping the pit road speed limit in place, regardless of whether the pits are open or not, I think you hit on the main reason for doing that. It boils down to safety, and particularly at a time when teams and pit crews are having to make adjustments as to exactly how they do stops because of how the changes in the side pods have occurred. I mean, we talked to the fueler a couple of weeks ago for Rubens Barrichello, and he was walking around wearing a boot. And the reason he was wearing a boot is because he got a little too close to the side of the race car, and it reached out and grabbed him. And he got tagged pretty good on the left ankle and suffered a bit of a fracture and a separation there. It's a different scenario under those pit stops. And, I think the move to open pit road, was designed, quite frankly, Paul, to make things just a little less hectic and a little safer as teams get used to dealing with the redesigned bodies. And it just gives the guys and gals more room to ply their trade. And let's face it, it also brings pit strategy into play and adds another element of excitement to it, and it adds another element to race day planning. So, you know, I think it's a move that most people seem to be in favor of, but again, we'll see as to what the end result is after we get a couple of races under our belt. We'll see what impact it has, if any. And let's face it, at the end of the day, if it's one of those rules that is deemed one of those changes that's deemed to be ineffective, and one that's not successful, and one that really doesn't work, then I think, you know, the option is there to always do an about face, and you can do so without losing face. I mean, let's face it, we've had that in the past. I mean, we had four lap qualifying a couple of years ago for all of the ovals. That turned out to not necessarily be something that the drivers were in favor of. You go to the Firestone Indy Lights series. We've had times in the past where we had two races in one day. On some road and street courses, teams certainly weren't in favor of that. So there have been a myriad of things over the years that we've attempted. You know, the twin races in Texas have fallen by the wayside. And, again, this I think falls under that heading of an attempt to do something to spice up strategy a little bit, on some of these road and street circuits and add a level of drama to it. But if it's deemed to be ineffective, then they can scrap it and go back to doing things the old ways where they pack the cars up before they open the pits.
So heading into Long Beach, certainly a track that traditionally we don't see a lot of passing. There's the one great opportunity into turn one and the one on the back straight, what is it, turn eight, I think, before you turn into the parking lot there. What are you looking for this year? What do you think the new car is going to change with the race this year?
Well, I think there's a couple of places down Seaside Way, that long back straightaway, I think will provide some opportunities. I've had the opportunity to be there above Turn 9 for the last a few years that we've been going there with the Izod Indy Car Series, and that'll be my position again this race day weekend. And I think you'll see the activity pick up there a little bit. There's always a lot of passing in that portion of the course. Sometimes it always doesn't occur among the front runners, certainly. But again, that's one of those tracks, let's face it, Paul, where track position is a premium. I mean, those that start out front usually stay out front as long as they don't, you know, suffer an ill-timed stop or, have some sort of mechanical issue, which, you know, as we've seen through the first couple of the races, is now not out of the question after not having that be an issue for several years. But one thing's for certain, after what we experienced at Barber, and I think what we saw to a certain extent at St. Petersburg, I think people have a bit of renewed enthusiasm for the possibilities for good racing on road and street circuits. And when you add to that the fabulous job that Jim McKellion and those associated with the Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach do, I think that in a relatively short amount of time, the luster has returned to that event. I think this year, with the stable of drivers that we put together, and the addition of people like Rubens Barrichello and the rise to prominence of James Hinchcliffe and some of the other drivers, I think you'll see an outstanding battle and a great race weekend in Long Beach, California this weekend.
Well, I certainly think it's going to be a great matchup this weekend between the engine manufacturers. I think in your neck of the woods down there in Turn 9, I think Chevrolet, it's going to be really neat to see the Chevrolets coming off of Turn 8 coming right at you down there where we understand that Chevrolet has a little more torque, a little more giddy up out of the corner. So coming out of slow Turn 8 down toward you at Turn 9, are they going to be able to make the passes going down the straightaway there? At the opposite end of the track where our buddy Jake Query, at least where he was last year, and I'm assuming he'll be this year, kind of wedged between Turn 1 and where the cars come back around past his backside toward Turn 6.
Right.
You think the Hondas has got to have a good advantage going down the long shoreline drive there, once they can get their turbos spooled up and heading down into Turn 1. So it sounds like they're each engine manufacturer may have their place where they can really make hay. So it's going to be interesting to see how the dynamics of this, the ebb and flow of the engine battles, and who can really get it done throughout the entire track. And you know, we saw a very surprise victory from Mike Conway last year. So certainly you expect some carnage during this race. Turn one, there's a big open space there, and I think a lot of drivers are going to get wide eyed, and someone's going to make some interesting moves like Elio did last year there. So I look for a little carnage there. If we see the electrical gremlins, we see people start getting off sequence with pit stops, some of these yellow flag changes, who knows what we could see in this race? We could see somebody come from 5, 6, 8 rows back, I think, legitimately, and maybe have a shot at winning this race if some of the cards fall their way.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm always excited when we have a first-time winner. Very happy for Mike Conway last year, of course, after the horrific accident that he was involved in, to see Mike come all the way back and find himself into victory lane was a very popular win in the series. And, you know, a great moment for one of the true class guys that we have up and down pit road. But, boy, to see a Joseph Newgarden or James Hinchcliffe or someone like that find their way into victory lane, I think would certainly be a great story. And yeah, it's going to be a neat battle between the engine manufacturers, and it's going to be a big challenge for the engineers to be able to find the right balance to make sure that they're fast and effective and at all portions of the course, not just the ones in which their particular design or their particular power plant is the most effective. But one thing's for certain, in every Eyes on IndyCar Series event, it seems like someone is dominant throughout the course of the weekend in practice and qualifying, and someone is dominant in the early stages of the race. But usually something unpredictable or unexpected happens, and then, you know, as you suggest, you find someone that comes from, you know, row 4 or 5 who all of a sudden is hanging around and finds himself in contention for the win. And we expect nothing less than that on the streets of Long Beach coming up this weekend.
Well, you got a horse you want to put your money on here for this weekend that you think may get it done?
Oh, I'm not very good at things like that, because if the drivers find out about it, they don't do well. They always accuse you of jinxing them. I mean, but I you know, the usual suspects will be there. Team Target, Team Penske. I've been awfully impressed with Simon Pagenaud and what he's been able to do with Sam Schmidt and Davey Hamilton's race team. You know, Graham Rahal and Charlie Kimball both have been quietly efficient through the first couple of race weekends, and I don't know, I may be repeating myself, but I don't think you could shortchange the impact that Joseph Newgarden has had at Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing. That would certainly be a great story, and maybe get her over the top in terms of her pursuit of the level of sponsorship that she enjoyed with Dollar General, which by the way, I know that she'd be the first one to thank them for all that they have done to help her get her race team off the ground and get it rolling, because they were a great partner. But boy, that was an unfortunate decision on their part to part ways with what I think is an up and coming race team in the series. But to get back to your original question, to be honest with you, Paul, I usually like to get through the first couple of practice sessions, and then we all start kicking around thoughts over dinner as to who we think the odds-on favorite will be to win. But I think if you were going to force my hand and say put money down on somebody, it does appear as though to me, and of course things can change in a moment, in an instant, but it does appear at least though initially to me that the number 3 is doing all he can to send a message to his boss and the Eyes on IndyCar series that he's not ready to ride off into the sunset anytime soon, and he thinks it's about time to fill that lone void on his resume, if you will, as an Eyes on IndyCar series champion. And I would have to put money on Elio Castroneves to be there at the end this weekend.
Well, I know Steph would chide me if I didn't offer my pick as well. So, and since you just took my pick there in Elio Castroneves, I'm going to go with his stable mate, his lesser renowned, or certainly his often overlooked teammate, and that's the number 2 car there of Ryan Briscoe. For the same reasons I think you said, I think he's just He wants to show that, hey, look, I'm here too. I'm running well this year. I've got something to prove, and I'm going to make my mark. I think this is the type of track.
I keep waiting for Ryan Briscoe to do a Rodney Dangerfield in front of a microphone at some point. You know, I mean, grab the tie and say I don't get no respect at all. I mean, I think Ryan Briscoe is perhaps one of the most underappreciated drivers we have in the series, and a lot of that has to do because of the teammates that he's with. But again, let's face it, Paul. You know, we talk about how important chemistry is to Andretti Autosport with the drivers that they have in their stable this year. Clearly, Roger has hit on a very successful combination with Will and Ryan and Elio. I mean, those guys talk about we before me. Don't get me wrong, they all want to win. Ryan wants to beat Elio and beat Will. Will wants to beat the other two, and Elio wants to beat the other two. But at the end of the day, when any of them end up in victory lane, the first handshakes typically come from the other two. And I think that's a testament to Roger Penske and Tim Cindric. I mean, when Will had an opportunity to still be in the contention for the championship last year, what did they do? They jumbled the teams up a little bit. They made some adjustments and, you know, switched engineers. It ended up not being, you know, the right move, unfortunately, because of an unfortunate incident on pit road in Kentucky that cost Will Power the championship. And it literally cost him the championship. But if were it not for that, it would have looked like a genius move on the part of Roger Penske. But, you know, Elio never foremouthed about it one time. He said, Will's got a chance to win the championship, and we're willing to do what we can to make that happen. And if you weren't a fan of Elio Castroneves before, I think the manner in which he celebrated the race at St. Petersburg certainly you know, added a few thousand to the number of people that that find Elio to be a class act, a true champion, and a sportsman. And I know we're supposed to stay neutral, Paul, but I think Elio's opportunities to win championships, I think he can be a viable contender for an Indy 500 win year in and year out for the foreseeable future. But let's face it, Elio knows that his opportunity to win championships might be slipping away just a little bit. And I think he had a very quiet offseason, and I think he came into 2012 poised to do all that he can to finally win one. And I, for one, would be happy to see that.
Couldn't agree more. I think he is certainly – he is due for his time, and I think, unfortunately, I think his number of years are waning. So I think this is the year he wants to get it done. I think there's a good chance he could get it done. So.
Yep.
Well, Mark – we could sit here and wax nostalgia all night, but old guys like us, we got to get up early of a morning, so I'm going to let you get going. I certainly appreciate you spending way more time than I had originally pegged you or requested of you, so I certainly appreciate that. And, you know, thanks for joining us, sitting down and talking about all these different issues. And we love talking IndyCar. We look forward to this weekend in Long Beach. Well, then we'll hit Brazil, and then before you know it, another 3 weeks, and we turn the calendar to May.
Yep, and Paul, we're awfully excited about it. This will be my 17th 500 with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, and every year feels exactly like the first. We have what I think is the greatest job in the world, I just am pleased and proud to have been a part of this series for so long, and there's just so many great people involved in it that both, you know, within the confines of the series, but. Let's face it, the thing that makes the series what it is certainly the fans. It's a cliche, but we just simply could not exist without them. And we're thankful for them, and we hope that the support continues to grow. But I know the series is thankful to have, you know, folks such as you and Steph out there applying your trades and doing what you do. And much like a lot of folks, you're not doing it for the financial rewards. You're doing it because you certainly love racing, you want to do anything and everything you can to see it grow and prosper, and it gives you an opportunity to be a part of it. And the series is fortunate to have you folks out there doing what you're doing, and we're thankful for the opportunity to promote the radio network and the Eyes Wide IndyCar series with you in any way, shape, or form we can.
Well, we certainly love to do it. Mark James, Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. You can hear him this weekend covering practice from the streets of Long Beach on IndyCar.com for each session along with Davey Hamilton and Jake Query will be on there, and I believe our friend Pippa Mann will be joining you for some of the sessions as well. Is that right?
That's right. She's the for the Firestone Indy Lights with me and Davey in the booth. She is the proverbial rose between the two thorns, if you will. There's no doubt about that. So yeah, we've gotten a lot of great response from Pippa being in the booth with us for the first couple of the races. But she's going to join me for qualifying, and then she'll join Davey and me for the Firestone Indy Lights race. So we're thrilled to have her, and we hope she's back in the cockpit real soon.
Well, don't let that sweet demeanor of hers put you off there, because she's got a few thorns to throw as well. I know. I've been on the receiving.
Well, I guarantee you one thing. You better be prepared if you're going to shake hands with her, because it's like putting your hand in a vise.
That's the truth. That is the absolute truth. So, fans, again, keep up with More Front Wing all weekend. We'll have our event summary, which is already posted on morefrontwing.com. Get all your important times, track facts, entrant facts, history, standings, everything you need to know about this weekend, including updated practice by practice with the official practice times. So we'll wrap it up there. Thanks again to Mark James, Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. And remember, when you need IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.